This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Mads Torgersen, Program Manager of C# at Microsoft. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join me, Mads.
Thanks for having me here, Brian. Exciting.
To start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a Danish guy who's been working for Microsoft for the last 11 years or so, pretty much in the same role all of the time. I'm what they call the language PM for C#, which means that I'm in charge of the design process for the next version of C#, whatever that may be at any given time.
And does that make you technical? Are you an engineer as well as a manager?
It makes me technical, and I'm actually not a manager. A program manager is not a manager at Microsoft, which is odd. An odd choice of naming, you could say. But it sort of means that you're in charge of a product, or it's your job to make sure that that product evolves well and is sort of alive and well, and everything that's supposed to happen with it happens. But in most cases, that is a pretty technical role. And in particular here in the developer division, where your customers are all very technical themselves, it is a very technical role. And so my sort of primary duty is to make us design new features for C# and put them in right.
And have you been, you said you've been, I'm sorry, I'm confused. Were you in this role for 11 years or you're at Microsoft 11 years? I'm sorry.
Yeah, both.
Okay.
So that's pretty much what I started doing almost exactly at the time when I got here. So I've been doing it for a long time.
What version was C# at 11 years ago? I've been programming since about 2005, but I don't remember.
We were just about to release C# 2.
Okay.
So when I came here, generics weren't officially released yet.
So C# 2, I think around then, I remember I was doing some web apps with .NET. I think it was 1.1, and I was rebuilding something in .NET 2. Is that around the same time frame?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Okay. But
yeah, 2005.
There isn't a direct relationship between the numbers for .NET or for C#, I'm pretty sure.
Only occasionally.
Yeah.
There was at that particular point in time. Everything was 2.0. When C# 2.0 and .NET 2.0 came out, then it all got messy.
So we're coming up, I think, is it C# 7 is the forthcoming release?
Yes, that's right.
So between, let's say, when you joined at 2 and up to the current, what would you say are the nicest things you introduce or the most beneficial?
I think there were two very big things that happened to the language that I think have long-lasting impact. When I joined, was when Link was being designed, language integrated query, which ended up in and of itself being a nice and expressive thing to have in a programming language, but also was the first big boost of what you could say functional DNA coming into this otherwise object-oriented language. And that's sort of a merger of cultures that we've been continuing ever since. So I think it was impactful both as concrete features, but also as kind of a setting a direction for the language, if you will, of being open to adopting things in from different cultures and merging them together, trying to make a seamless experience out of that. And then the other one I would point to is async that came out in C# 5, and which has sort of become viral, like other programming languages are adopting it left and right now. And that was a proud moment for us, having a feature that sort of really finally addressed the callback hell that was programming in any kind of distributed environment at the time, and doing it in a way that could be exported to other languages. So yeah, those are some of the good moments for me, for sure.
With something like Link, you were saying that you were looking at other languages out there and deciding to incorporate things. Was that something that came as a request from outside, or was it due to people within your group saying, hey, I like this other functional stuff and I want it for C#?
I think it's a combination always. I think what often happens is that people request some very specific things that they need in their day-to-day job. Like, couldn't you have embedded SQL in C# would be an example of that. Why don't you embed SQL into C#? So that I can use it to query my database without having to use strings, right? So that's a very concrete request. But if you do that, if you sort of just go and act on those very concrete requests, well, then you get SQL integration and nothing else. And that's sort of a little bit too specific for a programming language. And so what we did here is what we always have to do if we want to make successful features. We have to listen to what are the needs, what are the shortcomings in the language as expressed through all these different requests and questions from the users. But then we kind of we have to translate that into a generalized need that we then again have to translate into or invent our way into what would be a good feature set or steal our way from some other language into what would be a good feature set that would really address a multitude of these requests in one fell swoop and kind of be principled and general and take the language to a new level instead of just cluttering it with more features. So that's what happened in that case as well. We had a lot less openness around our design process back then. So we kind of made it up in secret, or I should say the team did, because I only joined towards the end of that. And then we only came out with it when there was quite a well-rounded design already in place. That's not how we do things anymore, but that was it at the time. But it was definitely based on a lot of feedback around how difficult it was to work with databases.
When you're working on or coming up with something like Link, incorporating it, do you remember which version of C-sharp it was? Was it going into 2 or to something
like that?
That
was C-sharp 3.
Okay, so when you're looking at something and you're going to say, all right, we're incorporating this into 3, you know that there's going to be a 4 or 5 and a 6 in the future. So when you're building Link, do you say, okay, this is really Link 1 and we have a bigger plan for Link 2 and Link 3? Or do you kind of go, this is pretty damn good and, you know, we'll tweak it in the future, but we have 100% of what we want?
I will say with Link, we definitely tried to design it in the full. We said, okay, it's well-rounded now. It's got everything we need. That's how we thought about it at the time. It so happened that we did evolve some of the parts of of Link again in subsequent versions. For instance, the expression trees that were introduced with Link were evolved some more for the dynamic release in C# 4.0, and they were reused for another purpose than what they were originally intended for. So sometimes we surprise ourselves and there's more to a feature than we initially thought when we had certain scenarios in mind. And I think we've gotten more and more aware of that fact now, and we're more sort of deliberately introducing features piecemeal sometimes. One example from the newest C# that's coming out, C# 7, is pattern matching, which is a feature you can take to many places. And we sort of said, let's get sort of the backbone of even getting the notion of a pattern into the language now, and then feel our way more sort of step by step into what are the right ways to then expand on that in subsequent versions. So we've become better at partly because of the openness and because of maybe the opportunities for a higher cadence than we can have with the language. We've become more open to just putting a concept in that we feel is solid and then trusting our future selves to expand on it as we see how people use the initial offering and as we learn more about where it would be good to take it.
Would you say you're as happy with the outcome with async? I know Link, very successful. I've used it. I like it a lot. Async, on the other hand, it's fine if you've got something like a web API or an MVC where you hit your controller, you hit your action method, it's async. You hit your database, you do an async call, you get back your results, you return your response. But as soon as you start getting into things like, I'm going to make 2 database reads and they're independent, so I'm going to wait for all of them, or I'm going to when all of them, or you know what, I've got some async mixed with sync. It really starts to get tough, and I've made a lot of mistakes. I've gotten to the point just last week where I was trying to do the thing where I have an API action method, 2 database reads, they're independent, so I put in 2 tasks and I when all of them. And half the time it worked and half the time it didn't. So guess what? I went back to 2 awaits. So stuff like that. I've spoken with Bill Wagner about this, and I think I spoke a little bit with a few other people. It seems to be still something that we're struggling with, we developers.
Right. So I think that there are two I'll try to separate two different aspects to the difficulties you can have with async. Some of them are inherent difficulties with the model, and some of them are accidental difficulties that sort of come from the way it's used or what we had to build it on top of and stuff like that. And so I view I'm very happy with the model. The sort of we call them tasks in our framework. Some people call them futures or promises. Building on that whole model, I think, is that is a very successful model that a lot of people have adopted before and after us and had a lot of mileage out of. And I think it gives a great language for, in and of itself, having that abstraction gives you a great language for combining tasks, like you went all, as you say, things like that. So you can sort of do an algebra with the futures or tasks themselves, combine them in different ways. And at the same time, then having the language support for awaiting them and creating new tasks out of old ones by awaiting in your method body, that seems to be a great combo. Now you have to kind of still, there's some inherent complexity in doing async. Whenever you do it, you have to deal with the fact that multiple things are going on at the same time. If you're doing it on your UI thread, well, things can happen to your state while you're awaiting. And so you kind of get into not quite, but almost the complexities of multi-threading. And if you're not on a single threaded context like the UI thread, then you can really get into multi-threaded issues like you're interleaving or even executing on different threads, your different snippets of functionality and so on. So there's sort of a complexity in there that you can't get away from, even if you have a better way of signing up your callbacks, so to speak, which the language feature is. And then on top of that, there was a huge big reality of what was already there in terms of frameworks and async APIs and so on. And you have to kind of just do your best to fit with that as well. And that wasn't made for this future, so to speak. It wasn't prepared for being async ready or whatever. And some of it is quite messy. So a lot of things come together that make it still a complex task to do async programming. No pun intended.
No, absolutely. But one of the things that, to go back to multi-threading, I've done not a massive amount, but you know, when I needed to, I would do multi-threading, not inside a web app, but it was for other things. I knew it was complicated. I knew I had to be really careful. I had to manage my thread pools. I had to manage anything that was shared. And I knew it was hard. Whereas async await makes you think it's easy. And, you know, the example I gave you, half the time I would hit my fiddler and say execute, and I would get my correct response, and half the time I wouldn't. But I could see a scenario where maybe the first 100 times it would work and the second 100 times it wouldn't. But I don't test it enough to find those problems. So it feels like there's a massive complexity that has been hidden, but maybe hidden a little too well, and it's maybe a little bit too easy.
Yeah, I'll totally take that. It's become very easy to shoot yourself in the foot with async. And there's a number of common mistakes that people make that are hard to debug, and you kind of just have to know. My best advice is always go look up Stephen Tobe's blog. He has the answers for the top three most common mistakes that people make, and those account for probably 90-some% of where you're kind of stranded and have no idea what to do next. So, but that just goes to show that the feature doesn't kind of just unpack itself for you as you use it. It has these depths of complexity that it's trying to pave over for the common case, and a lot of times successfully so. But then when things don't turn out right, it makes it perhaps even harder to debug in and find out what's wrong. It was actually bloody hard before then too. I mean, debugging async is just super, async code is just super hard regardless. But it kind of gives you this false sense of security. I think there's something to that.
Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I was looking at the HTTP client last week, and I think there isn't a synchronous post anymore. And it's just an async post. Do you know if I'm right about that? That some of the synchronous methods are gone and only async is available.
Right. There's a principle there where I can't tell you whether that particular instance, whether that's the case or not. But there's a principle there. This is something also that Stephen Tobe was very good at formulating when we started rolling out async, where how do you design your APIs? If something is inherently async, should you offer up a synchronous wrapper for it that essentially runs it on a thread, like allocates a thread for waiting for it? Or, how should you deal with that? When things are inherently synchronous, do you put an asynchronous wrapper on it? And we sort of arrived at this principle that I think is a good one, even though we don't follow it ourselves everywhere, which is don't lie. A method should not lie about their asynchronicity. You know, either they're asynchronous or they're not, and that's how they should expose themselves, and then leave it up to the consumer to bridge the gap. If you don't want an asynchronous call right now, you should be the one making the choice to spend a thread on that. It shouldn't be a choice that was sort of hidden behind even more layers of complexity. You need to be able to be in charge of your thread landscape, so to speak, because, you know, for better or worse, mostly worse, threads are a costly resource in the .NET world and in most programming languages, and you sort of need to let people be able to manage them themselves.
So those are some of the things from the current and the past C Sharp. But we have C Sharp 7 coming up. Is there a release date for it yet?
Is there what, sorry?
A release date? Do you know a final?
Yeah, I have a release date. I'm not going to tell you, though.
Okay. Would you say it's in 2017 or later?
It's 2017.
Okay.
That much I can say. We have announced that it's part of Visual Studio 2017. And okay. So if it doesn't make the calendar year it's named after, then that'll be a huge embarrassment. I don't think that'll happen. And people who watch our repos can glean that we're getting pretty close to ready with this thing. So, yeah.
So what's new? What are you most happy with or impressed with or think that will be the best for us mortals out there?
Well, there are a few things in C# 7 that are kind of big. I think the one that will most immediately impact a lot of people or be able to impact a lot of people is tuples, which just let you create values that are just made of other values, right? So you can just have a little three tuple with three values in, and you can pass that around. You can already do that using something like system.tuple today, but that's all just framework types that take a lot of effort to pack and unpack the values. What we've essentially done is to create language syntax for that. So you have a super simple approach to saying, well, this method returns these three values of these three types. You can even give them names, each individual component of that set of returns, if you will. And then the consumer has an easy way to either dot their way into the tuple they get back using those names, or they can actually deconstruct on the spot into three separate variables if they want to. So there's tuples and deconstruction together, giving you a super smooth way of just passing around and returning multiple values at the same time.
To me, that sounds like something I've been looking for since, I don't know, 2000 or 2001. How is it that it has taken until 2017 to get this?
That's a good question. We've actually tried a lot of times. Like, if I go back in, of course, we haven't shared these with the world yet, the old design notes from before we started designing in public, I can see that we've tried this a couple of times. We actually even had a prototype of tuples earlier on. And somehow we weren't able to get to the right design that we believed in before, and somehow we got there this time. And I can't say exactly what made the difference. I think if I have to be honest about it, some of it was that more other mainstream or sort of mainstream languages started to come out with their takes on tuples, and there were more different visions of what tuples could be out there that we could sort of steal from or learn from into our design. There was, back when we first started designing tuples, there was really only sort of the ML style functional language version of it, and we were worried about various things about that, including the lack of ability to communicate what each individual component is about. Like you just get a list of values. You don't get any naming or other hint what they're for. Like you get two strings, three strings, which is the first name, middle name, and last name. Like you kind of have to remember. So that was one problem we ran into. We didn't have a solution for at the time. And the other one was this thinking that they had to be allocated as objects, including the tuple type that we have in the framework is a class type, and it allocates a lot. And we've always been a little concerned, and increasingly so, about allocation costs with primitive language features. So we just couldn't really get it right. And this time we sort of nailed the design. It is, and another thing is, like, how are the tuples stored in metadata? Are they, are they based on a predefined type, or do we generate new types every time around? So this, being able to figure out how to give tuple components names without generating a whole lot of new types from the compiler every time, that was sort of, I think, that was one of the keys of having the right design. The other one being making them structs, making them mutable, making them super simple in their structure. That sort of just, it came together right this time. I can't tell you exactly why we didn't think of it that way before, but now was just when our minds were there. So now it's there.
Any other major feature that you'd like to highlight?
Well, I already mentioned pattern matching a little bit. Mm-hmm. Pattern matching are a complete mainstay of functional languages. And what they let you do is to have what you could sort of call shape-dependent behavior in a different way than object-oriented languages do. So in an object-oriented language, you can have a hierarchy of types and you can have virtual methods across that hierarchy, and each shape can sort of behave its own way, but only for things that are inherent to that type, that are built into the type, right? A virtual method has to be declared inside of the base type and implemented by everyone overridden by everyone who derives from that. So it's very tied up to the type itself. It's sort of only, you can only do that shape-dependent behavior if you think of it when you write the type. Functional languages take the opposite approach. You define a set of types, and they are essentially behaviorless, and then you write functions that do what you could call a type switch or a shape switch am I looking at a rectangle? Am I looking at a circle? What am I looking at? And then you can specify in a very clear, terse, syntactic manner what to do for each of those things that you expect to encounter in your function. And so that means the function can be defined completely separately from the types. And it turns out, both are useful. I think that especially sort of the cloud age has put pressure on the object-oriented model in that you kind of want to have the same data and the same shapes of data be used in multiple different contexts that have different functionality over them. And so being able to divorce functionality from data is very important. So that was a long-winded way of saying this is what pattern matching is for. Now I can write a function using pattern matching that goes against somebody else's types and yet is able to do different things for different shapes of that data.
We're going to change tack a little bit, so to get out of the very technical side of it and maybe a little bit more into the less technical. What I wanted to ask you was, how do you as an individual manage something as big as C#?
Well, part of it is that I only manage, in quotation marks, the language design itself. Like, there's a huge organizational structure at Microsoft that deals with all other aspects of the C# experience, like the .NET libraries and runtime, and the compiler is that now has its own surface area through the Roslyn APIs and so on. Like, there are many people responsible for the different components, and I'm sort of just one person who's responsible for the language design, but I have a whole design team that I work with, and I also now have the backing of a whole lot of people in the community who pitch in via our open design process on GitHub. So it's not me, sitting in my own corner coming up with wacky ideas and putting them into C# on my own. There's a whole system of people who meet. Actually, we meet like 4 hours a week just to design C#. Currently, they're all Microsoft people. We might be open to having other people. We were sort of gearing up to have some Xamarin people in there as well, but then we bought them, so now they're also Microsoft people. But that sort of that design team is implementers of C# at Microsoft, as well as various other people who have an interest in the language. So it's both compiler people and IDE people, trying to bring all those perspectives to it. And then we bring in people from other teams as needed when we have things that have particular cross-cutting effects with libraries, tools, whatever. So it's a big set of people coming up with the ideas and then a specific group kind of working through them and making sure that these proposals are they sort of are the right thing to put into the language in the first place and kind of honing them to feel C#-y. That's sort of a core group of people that I call the C# language design team. We kind of have to marry the breadth of input and the enormous amount of things you could do and ways you could do them with a focus on keeping the language at least relatively simple and keeping it sort of in its own spirit so that it keeps appealing to the people who already use it while providing meaningful evolution and progress and also hopefully some appealing news to people who are thinking about adopting it. It's all a balancing act there.
When you talk about C#, the language, you are not, I think, referring to things like entity framework or Web API or MVC or any of those other things that I use on a daily basis.
Right. Those have other people who are in charge of their design, and we just collaborate as needed. So sometimes, I mean, one thing that we've been able to preserve, one good thing about the old Microsoft way that we've been able to preserve as we've been going open source and had more community involvement in the design process is a high degree of collaboration and a focus on these cross-cutting experiences where it's not just about a language feature or a library, but we do something across the board. Async is a magnificent example of that, for instance, where you know, it was not just about putting a new feature into the language. It was about streamlining the frameworks around it and creating new tooling and, async debugging. And we can do that kind of cross-cutting thing, even as these things become more more open and involve more components that aren't Microsoft-owned. If you think about, I think a lot of, at the language level, a lot of what enables that is Roslyn, the Roslyn APIs and framework. So when we think about tooling now, we don't just think about Visual Studio. We think about, well, how is that surfaced through Roslyn and this community project called OmniSharp, which wraps essentially editor services around Roslyn. How do we surface it through that so that it it benefits people who are using other editors and using OmniSharp to provide the C# support in those. But we can still use Visual Studio as our exemplar of what an IDE experience would be. So we still design for a good IDE experience, even as we're not targeting it specifically to Visual Studio anymore.
Because other things rely on C#, obviously Web API does, Entity Framework and all of them, I imagine, and I think I know that there are occasionally conflicts. I remember being at a talk and someone was expressing that at some point, this was around async and await, I think it was that the C# team didn't want to allow voids to be returned from an async method, but MVC or WebForms team needed them for events or something of that nature, and that there was a significant disagreement.
Well, there was a significant disagreement about that issue, but it wasn't actually on as clear-cut lines as you lay out there. It was just a really hard conundrum, right? And we get into these. Look, we still do. We get into these design questions that just don't have an obvious right answer. Sometimes, if you think long enough about it and you kind of throw it around enough times, then all of a sudden you get this epiphany and things just fall into place and everything's great. Like when you have that, Yeah, wonderful. And we've had a few of those, and I've learned to cherish those, because then there are the more common cases of, well, we have to choose here, but there's no clear, obvious winner. And somebody will be pissed if we do this thing. Somebody else will be in trouble if we do the other thing. But we just have to choose, because not doing anything is worse than doing any of those two things. And so we've had early examples of the async void is a source of constant pain, and it's not a surprise to us. We knew it would be. Not having async void would also have been a source of constant pain. Okay, too bad. You know, we don't actually, I don't think we could say, oh, in hindsight, we should have done this or that instead. We just knew that there would be pain down either path. And sure enough, the one we picked certainly had it. We're seeing the same thing now. We've had a discussion about, on a smaller scale, about in terms of pattern matching and the out variables that we're also introducing to C# 7. We're now starting to introduce variables in the middle of expressions. Okay, before it was always with a statement or parameters, something outside of the expressions. Now you can actually introduce a variable in the middle of an expression. Question, what should the scope of that variable be? That's a new kind of thing we have to decide on. And it turns out you can make the scope narrower, or you can make it broader. If it's narrower, then you don't get as much leakage of variables you didn't need anywhere else, and you don't get problems with running out of good variable names. But then you also don't get the benefits of having it broader when you have scenarios where you want to use that variable in the next statement. And we tussled over that, and we changed our minds, and we made a decision that is sort of erring on the side of having a more useful feature, but maybe a little less pure. So we went for the broader scope. And folks in the community are upset about it. But they would be upset also if we missed the opportunity to address those scenarios. Other people would be upset. So we just find ourselves in these conundrums, and we just do our best with all the input we can get and with our own good brains to just make the call that is the least painful. We can never find out whether we made the right choice, right? We never see the alternate reality where we make the other choice.
And is that part of your individual role as the program manager to say, we're making this decision and that's my choice? Or is it a more of a vote or a consensus, or what's the process?
Right. So it comes down to the design team, the language design team, and I try to get consensus or vote by overwhelming majority on as many decisions as possible. They stick better if they're made collectively. There have been cases where I just had to say, you know what, this is what we'll do. And then that falls to me. But I'm very reluctant. I'm a very reluctant dictator, if you will. I prefer to have something that people can, if not agree to, then at least agree that it's a reasonable outcome. So very rarely do I draw the line and say, hey, let's end this. This is how we go. But it has happened. It happens in every release.
Are there times with your releases that you just don't have the capacity to get something in that you would want, and you say, "All right, we're cutting it. It'll be the next one." Okay, you nodded to that, and I want the really question I wanted to get to is, how is it that Microsoft don't have infinite resources and developers to get everything they want in? That's the real question I wanted to get to.
Okay, well, nobody has infinite resources, and you know, it's easy when you sit in your own little corner of the world, being a hammer, if you will. Everything's a nail, and who needs screwdrivers, right? And so I can, as a language designer, I can sit here and say, why don't we just spend all our buck on more language features? Why am I running out of resources here? Why don't we just double the compiler team and the IDE team and all the downstream teams that have to kind of implement something because of the language features? At the end of the day, though, everyone here is working on valuable features for developers. Everyone in developer division is working on something that is super valuable, and there's only so many resources to go around. You can sometimes get a boost from, again, from being open source and having the community. And I think you see that particularly strongly for our sister, our little sister language, F sharp, which is even much more carried by community contributions than we are in C sharp. C sharp is well funded compared to F sharp, which has fewer users, right? And less of a business impact to Microsoft than C sharp does. And so yes, it's funded less. It's funded sufficiently to keep it afloat, but in particular, it's funded sufficiently to provide sort of I won't say steering, but make sure that the community contributions make it in, they get properly evaluated, and that someone is responsible for integrating it all. And so, there we're making do with fewer Microsoft resources and just getting a huge boost from a community that's eager to contribute features at every level.
There was something I wanted to ask you about that. Standards bodies, because there's a few of them out there. There's .NET Foundation and there's something else. I can't remember the name, but I've spoken with Bill Wagner and John Skeet about those things. And they say they have these meetings, these big Skype calls around the world, 12 time zones, where they kind of come up with the standards. But, you know, listening to you, you made a comment earlier, we, Microsoft, weren't able to get the design we wanted. So where is the relationship between Microsoft's decisions on C-sharp and these other bodies that have some input into C-sharp?
Right. So let me say a little bit about how the standardization process works. So C-sharp is yet again being standardized through ECMA, which is a European standards body. And C-sharp was actually standardized through ECMA in version 1 or 2, and then interest kind of fell away because there weren't other implementers of C-sharp at the time, or that many other implementers. There was just Mono, and we talked to those people through other channels and so on. But now, in the interest of openness, we're back in standardizing it. And I think it's a really useful activity, but it is it works a little differently per language. But the C-sharp standards body is not a design body. It's not its primary purpose is not to invent C-sharp, if you will. It is to make sure that there is a clear specification for what C-sharp does and should do that can be followed by implementers and that expresses very clearly what the semantics of C-sharp are. So it is sort of a trailing activity, if you will, after the language has been designed. Then there's this effort to ideally, once the standards body catches back up to all those releases it wasn't part of, ideally in short order after the release, to kind of do a review, if you will, as well, and make sure that the semantics are clearly expressed. So we just started doing it a couple of years ago again, and there were three versions of C-sharp that went unstandardized. And so we're just putting the finishing touches on a standards proposal for C-sharp 5, actually. And then hopefully we can go faster standardizing C-sharp 6 and then C-sharp 7 and kind of catch up where the standardization happens in close proximity to the design of the language, maybe even before Microsoft ships an implementation. So we'll see how that goes. But right now, it's definitely very trailing by a few years.
So what are the benefits you get out of this process? Because, you know, to me, and I put this, I think, to Bill Wagner, that it sounds like Microsoft is really leading it. Microsoft decides if Microsoft wants to go a particular way, they will. And not in a bad sense, but there's no one that can stop them.
No, I think it is mostly about producing an agreed upon clear specification of what C-sharp is. So the standards is a very rigorously reviewed specification of C-sharp. That's what it is. And that is a very valuable thing for Microsoft to have and for everyone who works with the language in one way or another, including people who are using it to write code and also people who are writing tools that work over C-sharp. Like, think of somebody like JetBrains that write all kinds of tooling against C-sharp. Well, the spec is invaluable to them, and they kind of lacked I haven't heard this concretely from them, but people like them haven't really had an authoritative source to go to like we've written a specification from Microsoft, but it hasn't been rigorously reviewed in the same way. They haven't had this good source of this is what it's supposed to do. And this is clearly spelled out what the rules are, what the corner cases are, and so on.
You've mentioned a few times the open source community, and over the years, Microsoft's relationship with open source has changed enormously. Where do you see C Sharp, or how do you see C Sharp benefiting, and where do you see the relationship going over the next few years?
I think C Sharp has already benefited hugely. There's a few different ways that you benefit from open source, and the sort of just the openness of dialogue, if you will, where people can respond to things happening in real time instead of waiting for some big reveal at some Microsoft conference somewhere. So it's a much tighter loop of communication. That's sort of just the openness part of it. And then there's the source part of it, which is that that people outside of Microsoft participate increasingly on equal footing in the development of the tools and products. So that's where we can really sort of get a boost of effort, if you will. And that sort of comes with also a community engagement in the future of the product, if you will, where if somebody cares to build it, well, then they just influence the direction of it. So I think that that sort of, we're only going to do more of that in the future, and more community initiated features will make it in. I think Microsoft has enough, for the foreseeable future, Microsoft has enough of a business need for C Sharp that we will keep sort of a majority stake in it, if you will, or try to. But it's not really the kind of business interest that is nefarious in the way that we are sort of secretly going to do something to it, or we're going to lock some platforms or communities out or whatever. It is more that we know we have close contact with millions of C# developers through our tools offerings, and we kind of know what helps them keep appreciating C#, if you will. And that's good for our business purposes too.
I remember in the past, not that long ago, and you know, these are things I just heard from various people, that certain banks and large financial institutions tended to like Microsoft because it was closed source, and they tended to avoid the open source community. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that was the story. But now that Microsoft is going much more open source, have you seen any comments coming back from, I don't know, let's say the Banks of America and the likes going, hey, man, we don't like this?
Look, this was a big fear that that was also, I won't say prevalent, but it was strong in Microsoft as we started to make the change to open source. Are we going to lose credibility with some of our important customers? Because some open source projects have, there've been various stories about, you know, then everybody leaves the project or takes it in a different direction, and somebody took a dependency on it, and it became very expensive for them to have that dependency and see things go away or go the wrong way. And so it's been very important for us as we move to open source to make sure that we had the same degree of trustworthiness around the quality of the products. Right? And so that's another reason why we keep a strong stake in it, right? We want to make sure that we are open source as we're open source, we take a lot of responsibility for the quality of the products that people have taken a dependency on that we're part of. So we can still ensure that in an open source world, right? We can still make sure that the code is high quality and goes, we can still go in a good direction. We essentially provide backup for if everybody outside of Microsoft abandons a project or decides to go in a different direction, we can say, well, that's not good for our customers. We can even fork it if we never haven't gotten to that kind of conflict. It's more that we can represent the interests of our customers in the open source process.
Are you talking about there things like very popular NuGet packages that are open sourced, and in the event that the owner decides they've had enough, is that what you're referring to, or is it something else?
Well, there's definitely been cases of that where some technology has been abandoned, where the owners just let it go for various reasons. And I think that's what people have been that's one of the things people have been a little afraid of here.
And has that happened and Microsoft has stepped in to provide support or to provide a replacement?
I don't know of a clear-cut case of it, but there's certainly been cases where I don't want to mention examples, but where community-initiated projects have that we have invested in or taken a dependency on have had less engagement over time for various reasons, people needing to do other things or whatever, and we have stepped up our involvement to make sure that the commitment we made is still strong. Yes, that has happened.
Okay, I see what you mean. You, the C-sharp group, have a dependency on something which maybe the original developer is no longer interested in.
Yes.
I see. I this has a sort of an interesting aspect of this. I know that, I can't remember whether it's a C-sharp team or whether it's a .NET team. They rely very heavily on MyGet now, which was started by just two developers in, I think, Belgium. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to see Microsoft branching out and using the things that are being developed by the community and embracing them wholeheartedly. Whereas, you know, this is a long time ago, but we know the history that Microsoft wasn't quite so nice to such communities in the past.
Right. It's been a very perilous existence to provide third-party things in next to Microsoft's machine. Like when you never knew when Microsoft would step up and kind of just shove you out of the market or whatever. So that has changed a lot. And the skepticism that has been internally at Microsoft towards third-party solutions, whether they be libraries or tools, whatever, has completely gone away now. I think we just appreciate the more kind of not just diversity in terms of the choices out there, but also the more stakeholders there are in the sort of accumulated future of .NET, I think the better for us. And I think we've gone through a very healthy change of mentality there over the past half decade or so.
And was there a sort of a starting moment where someone said, this is what we should do, or was it a more kind of, let's use the word, organic, where people wanted to go that way and started doing it in small ways?
It's hard for me to say for sure. I'm not sure that there was a single thing that started it, but there were a number of projects that happened internally at Microsoft around the same time that all kind of wanted to do it. I do want to say that ASP.NET and F# were both front runners when it came to open source. And then there were some projects that kind of quickly followed, including the Roslyn project with C# and VB, and also TypeScript, which was also open sourced as quickly as we could. And that was back when there was still a lot of legal hurdles, and essentially the Microsoft bureaucracy didn't yet know how to deal with these things. And so in many ways, we were sort of the guinea pigs for developing the processes that a big commercial entity needs to have in place in order to trust itself to do open source right and not get into trouble legally or otherwise. So we were kind of early adopters of open source in that sense. And it's been good to see how there's sort of been a good feedback between the company bureaucracy, if you will, or legal branch and the engineering teams that have been pushing open source, and some really good processes have been worked out where everybody can just get out of each other's way and get things done. It's been a very good process.
Any final notes before we wrap up and let you get out for lunch, Mads?
Well, as always, I'd love for people to go out and play with C# 7.0. I said it wasn't released yet, but there are near complete versions of it already out there. You can download a release candidate of Visual Studio 2017. You can download the extension for VS Code, the C# extension that already supports C# 7.0. And I would just love for you to take it for a spin. And I'm always happy to hear from folks if they have thoughts and things that that think we should add. It's a little too late to change any of those things in C# 7, but any new ideas or whatever, bring it to our GitHub site, send me email at mats.torgerson@microsoft.com. I'm always happy to hear people's reactions.
You said there are some videos on Channel 9, I think?
Right. Yeah, so on Channel 9, if you want to get the 5-minute quick primer on C# 7, there's a video of me there. There's also longer talks if you have the stomach for watching me for an hour, go into more details. And I put out a blog post a few previews ago that essentially covers all of the C# 7 features in a little more detail.
I'll put links to all of those things in the post for the podcast. Well, Mads Torgerson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salted golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look at the river as it winds down the rise like a tear going down Cheekside Creek to the body of blood salty golden, holding the life of our own, though we do not look.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Look at the River by Isla Nerio from the album The Code of Flowers.